It's 4:06, and you're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Daylight savings time ends this Sunday, November 3rd. We'll gain an hour of sleep, but lose an hour of daylight in the evenings.
Daylight savings time became a popular practice worldwide in the 70s with the intent of saving energy.
Some people have said it hasn't actually achieved its goal. Maybe we should do away with it altogether. And we want to hear what you think. Give us a call at 800-642-1234. Do you like changing the clock twice a year, or is it a nuisance? You'd like to get rid of it? It's not worth it. 800-642-1234 is the number to call, or you can post on the Central Time Facebook page.
Joining us to make the economic argument for doing away with daylight savings time is Allison Schrager. She's an economist and writer for Quartz and Reuters. Her article in Quartz today is called "The U.S. Needs to Retire Daylight Savings and Just Have Two Time Zones, 1 Hour Apart." Allison, welcome to Central Time.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Well, let's start with your proposal that's pretty radical. We've got four time zones going on. You want to reduce it to two. How come?
Well, I mean, it's really not so radical when you think about in the historical context that we used to have 300 time zones, because ideally your time puts you at your true solar time, which is when the sun is directly above you at noon. So it used to be that every single town had its own sundial, and that kept you on your true solar time. But we moved to four time zones just for as commerce became more integrated for greater coordination. And really, that's really why we want to stay on the same time zone from an economic perspective, is commerce becomes easier and more efficient when we're on more similar time. And it just seems to make sense that as work becomes more integrated, you have more people working from home, companies have remote offices. I'm sure we've all had the experience of having to arrange conference calls with people in different time zones, that maybe we should move to even fewer just so to increase coordination.
So your main argument is coordination, because there are also health risks that come into play. Apparently people have more heart attacks when the clock goes back.
Yeah, I mean, there's been some results that show some correlation with usually in the spring of having to get up an hour earlier and people being more tired, and that may be putting some stress on the heart.
And what about, you know, people who say that, you know, they live on the West Coast, but they have to work on East Coast time? Now, is that part of your argument that, you know, those people can live in less of a greater dissonance or less dissonance in terms of the time that they're toggling between?
Exactly, because it just leads to more confusion, and it's harder to coordinate. And even if you only have a fraction of people in California who work on East Coast time, the fact is everyone else has to be there and provide services for them, or they don't get as much time with their family. So really, everyone pays the cost, even if you don't work on East Coast time but live on West Coast time.
So what about savings in energy? Is there actually the point to be made that, you know, daylight savings time is working like it's supposed to, and we are actually, you know, saving energy?
The evidence doesn't seem so conclusive. I mean, if anything, the reports I've seen based on California daylight savings suggest that there isn't really significant energy savings, because anyway, you have more daylight in the morning, you have less daylight in the evening.
What is the relationship right now, would you say, between time zones and the way that our business world works?
I'm sorry, what do you mean the relationship?
Right. I mean, how does it function now? Do you think that it's too dysfunctional to continue? Because if you look at the map, you've got the U.S. observes all these different time zones, the time change, and, you know, parts of Africa, Europe, but a large part of the world doesn't. So how do you think that works?
Yeah, see, that's exactly what's dysfunctional about it. I mean, in theory, if every single country at the same day, at the same time, observed daylight savings, maybe it wouldn't be such a big problem. But the fact that we observe daylight savings this Sunday, the Europeans already have, it causes a lot of havoc for the airline industry, you can imagine, because they do all their schedules based on flights lasting a certain amount of time. And then all of a sudden, the time zones change just for a couple of weeks. And as well, if anyone has ever had European offices they've had to deal with, there's always a lot of misscheduling. So it's really in the spirit of coordination. And one of the reasons I propose we go to fewer time zones is just in that moving towards more coordination spirit.
I want to take a phone call now. Let's go to Kevin in Janesville. Hi, Kevin.
Yes, hi. I would like to recommend that we do away with daylight saving. Two reasons. I believe I read once that Ben Franklin suggested it totally as tongue-in-cheek. And second of all, if standard time is really so standard, how come it's only 4 months out of the year?
Oh, excellent points. Have you heard about those arguments, Allison?
I have. I read about that Ben Franklin was the one who originally proposed it, but I never knew he was being tongue-in-cheek. That's good to know.
And what about the 4 months in standard time?
Well, I mean, it seems like it was always creeping up because, I mean, it was really throughout the 20th century that we introduced daylight savings, and it kind of was an on-again, off-again relationship we had with it. And, you know, each municipality could decide whether or not they wanted to observe it. And then it wasn't until the 60s that the U.S. said, all right, everyone has to observe it unless a state opts out of it. And then in the 70s, they kept adjusting when we would observe it. And the last time we changed it was in 2005. So it just adds to the confusion that we're constantly changing when we observe it. It's not in sync with anyone else.
And then you've got two states that are opting out of it altogether.
Exactly. And Indiana certain counties used to opt out of it.
That's confusing. All right. Well, Kevin, thank you for that call. We go to Margaret in Two Rivers next. Hi, Margaret.
Hi. I wanted to get rid of it. I've been wanting to get rid of it for decades. I'm an 83-year-old woman, and it's been driving me crazy ever since this started. during the Second World War, we did have to stay on it because of getting the troops from one side of the country to the other. They were still using trains back then. So, it gets me annoyed. I feel without missing for the whole time, and then when I get the missing hour back, it takes me a couple of weeks to adjust to that.
What do you think about the idea that our guest has of having just two time zones in the United States, one for the sort of east and one for the west?
Are we going to cut this off at the Mississippi River?
Sure. I don't know.
I mean, I'm trying to think of something sensible for a change. But have you ever looked at the map of the which you know,
right?
You know, yeah. You can have states that have three different zone times. I think the lady who said Indiana, that's it. If there's one on the east, then the one in the middle is different. And to the west, I'm not sure what's going on there.
Right. All right. Well, thank you so much, Margaret. And what do you think about what Margaret said? It's been bugging her for 83 years.
Yeah, I can't blame her. I mean, in theory, the whole purpose of time is so that we're better coordinated and it's simple. But we've made it so unnecessarily complicated.
So, Allison, you know, this has been going on since 1883, and it was designed for commerce back then. It was kind of, you made the argument that it's antiquated, but what are the chances that, you know, something like a plan like yours would ever go into effect?
Well, I mean, probably not likely, but you never know. I mean, China's on one time zone, and they naturally span five. Alaska is on four natural time zones, but they're pretty much the whole state's on one. So it happens. But right now, I don't feel like there's any momentum to change our time zones.
All right. Well, we'll see what happens, and we'll set our clocks back. In the meantime, Allison, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
That was Allison Schrager, economist and writer for Quartz and Reuters.
This is Central Time. I'm Rob Farad.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. Coming up, WPR News Director Michael Leland will catch us up on the top stories in Wisconsin.
First, we're talking about the Hindu Festival of Lights, Diwali, which is this Sunday.
Here to give us a Diwali 101 is Ranga Rajan, a member of the Indian Graduate Student Association at UW-Madison. Ranga, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you.
Well, let's start with the basics. So what is Diwali?
Well, Diwali is one of the oldest festivals of India, dating way back to 500 BC. In Hindu mythology, the reason why we celebrate Diwali is to welcome back the Aryan king Rama after he defeated his enemy Ravan, who was considered a symbol of evil. Now, although this is a Hindu festival, there are other religions also who celebrate this festival. For example, in the Jain religion, the occasion is to celebrate the attainment of Nirvana by the Lord of Mahavira. So the exact reasons may be different, but a lot of religions celebrate this festival, and the overarching theme is the victory of good over evil.
How important is Diwali to the Hindu religion and some of the others that you're talking about, like the Jain religion?
Well, Diwali is the biggest festival in India, cutting across religions. It is even a national holiday in India. So it is really important. People welcome prosperity and wealth into their homes and businesses. So traditionally, you know, people celebrate Diwali by saying prayers, lighting oil lamps in and outside their houses. They prepare and serve lots of sweets and snacks, visit each other's houses. It's a really big party that the whole country celebrates.
Is this the holiday that's been called the Festival of Lights?
That is true. This is the Festival of Lights. And so if you just go to India, you will see all the streets are lit up by electric lighting and also by oil lamps, which are the traditional so-called diyas. And so it's very beautiful out there.
So in terms of the beauty of it, what would we see if we went to India today?
Well,
you mentioned the lights.
Yes, you will see lots of lights, lots of people out there on the streets celebrating, wishing each other, distributing sweets. The young children will be bursting firecrackers, although that does cause a lot of pollution and it's being cut down right now. Mm. But lots of shopping going on, so people who like to shop. There are lots of shopping going on for clothes, trinkets, electronics, and things like that.
And how is the Indian Graduate Student Association celebrating the holiday?
Yes, unfortunately, we don't have a national holiday here, but to make up for the festivities, we are bringing a flavor of Diwali to UW campus by organizing a big cultural show called Diwali Night, which has lots of entertaining dance, music, and theater acts. This has been going on for the last 10 years, and the show culminates in a spectacular fireworks display on Lake Mendota. This year, Diwali Night is scheduled for Sunday, 10th November. From 6 p.m. to 8:30 p.m. in Mills Hall. And it's a free event, so no door fee, no tickets. Everyone is welcome to enjoy and the fun. And so that's what we are planning for Madison this year.
All right. Well, Ranga, thanks for joining us, and happy Diwali.
Thank you. Happy Diwali to you, too. Thank
that
you.
Was Ranga Rajan, a member of the Indian Graduate Student Association at UW-Madison.
This is Central Time. As I dimly recall, music classes and music lessons can be fun and challenging for kids. But our next guest says, along with the scales and the recitals, music education teaches kids valuable lessons about life and success.
And we want to hear from you. Were you in school bands? Did you play an instrument? And do you think that it actually helped you later on in life, in school or at work? And how so? If you're a music teacher, you could call us and tell us about the benefits of musical training as you see it. You can reach us at 1-800-642-1234. That's 1-800-642-1234. Or send your email to talk@wpr.org.
Joanne Lipman joins us now. She's a journalist and editor, co-author of the book Strings Attached, One Tough Teacher and the Gift of Great Expectations. Her piece on the benefits of music was in the New York Times. We've got a link to that on the Central Times Facebook page. Joanne, welcome to the show.
Oh, thank you for having me. Great to be here.
So what's the link between musical training and success?
So the Times piece that you're referring to grew out of the book Strings Attached, which you mentioned, which is about this incredibly remarkable, inspirational music teacher in a public school in New Jersey whose students went on to outsize success. And, I mean, in a larger sense, it really is about kind of the mentors that we all have in our own lives, and whether it be music teacher or a coach, you know, the person who kind of changes your life. But there is this connection that we've uncovered between music training and all of the skills that you learn with music training and success in later life. There's studies that link music training to academic success, but what we found is that there's all these other qualities that are really essentially life skills that you need whether you become a musician or not.
Now, you list lots of people, you encountered lots of them who were musicians and have gone on to achieve great things. Can you tell us about a few of them?
Sure. So I spoke to, one of the things as we were researching Strings Attached is I kept noticing that there were all of these really outstanding people in different fields who had started out as musicians. And I just kind of kept a running tally of them, and I thought, you know, I wonder if there, first of all, is there a link and what would they see in it? And so basically I picked up the phone and called all these people and everybody wanted to talk about it. It was fascinating. So one of the people I spoke to was Alan Greenspan, who was chairman of Federal Reserve, of course, and who many people do not know actually was a professional clarinet and saxophone player who actually attended Juilliard and played in a jazz band before he decided to go back for his economics degree. Another person I spoke to was Paul Allen, who was the co-founder of Microsoft, who spoke about kind of what music had done for him. He started out as a violin player, switched to guitar, and he told me he actually came to a fork in the road in high school where he could have gone on and become actually a professional rock guitarist. Or he could have gone into programming. And as he said, that turned out pretty darn well.
Now, when you talk... not a bad choice, I guess.
Not a bad choice,
When you talk to people like that, what do they say about their musical background that helped them in their non-musical careers?
Exactly. So what's so fascinating is just about everybody I spoke to made a connection between the qualities they learned in music and their success later in life. And so one of the things they talked about was the focus and the discipline that music training requires. Another thing that they mentioned, and actually I found this fascinating, this is something that Alan Greenspan alluded to, that Paul Allen did, was this sort of as music opening up pathways to creativity. And when I spoke with Paul Allen, he described music as sort of the flip side, as he said, of his analytical brain. And it basically kind of opens your mind to hearing things differently. And actually, almost everybody I spoke to talked about the idea of listening and processing and also kind of putting together disparate strands of thought. So, one of the people I spoke to was Woody Allen, who plays the clarinet. He actually still plays professionally. And then I spoke to a couple of broadcasters, very interesting, Chuck Todd, who many people know of as he's the White House correspondent for NBC, was actually a very, very serious French horn player who went to college on a French horn scholarship. And he talked about how he uses the focus, the discipline, the listening, the ability to kind of pick these disparate strands and kind of make some sense out of it, all to his training on the French horn. And another broadcaster, Paula Zahn, who many people know, also she went to school on a cello scholarship. And she said she used to spend 3 and 4 hours every day in a room basically practicing the detail work of one phrase in a piece of music. And she said those qualities really bring home to you the ability to focus, to listen, to be able to absorb things quickly. She said, all the things that she learned that she needed to be a journalist on Deadline came out of that practice room.
Joanne, how do we know that all the success you're talking about can be ascribed to music? Because you're talking about these kind of super achievers. Isn't it possible that these people are just really hard workers and they would be working hard no matter what they did?
That was why I made the phone call in the first place. And that's such a great question. It's also at the heart of the book Strings Attached, which was the reason that we wrote Strings Attached, which tells the story of this one remarkable public school music teacher who inspired thousands of kids, and they went on to outsize success compared to, kind of their peer group in their school. And that was kind of the question that we wanted to get to the heart of, which is, what comes first? Is it that kids who are going to be achievement-oriented are attracted to music, or is it that music somehow helps develop these skills? And I think that, in a sense, it's both. But there, pretty much everyone who I spoke to in these high achievers said that music helped hone whatever those skills were that were necessary for them to achieve. But I do think, yes, I would, frankly, I think that you do have, music does sort of attract people, and those people who tend to be high achievers.
Getting back briefly to your point about creativity, I hear again and again these fields like math, programming, that we think of as analytical are actually way more creative than we thought. Is that part of why people, in just a minute or so before we go to news, saw music as such a lesson there for them?
We have seen in the research that there is a connection between the math and musical processing. But what was far interesting to me was, as I spoke to these people, because that has been established, but the way that people talked about that, who are higher math people like Paul Allen, like there's a hedge fund manager by the name of Bruce Kovner who was a pianist at Juilliard. And the way they spoke about it was less about kind of numbers and more about how you relate to pattern recognition, how you relate to kind of how you process. It was more about the thought process and less about kind of a pure numerical equivalency.
Well, we're talking right now to Joanne Lippman about the unexpected benefits of music education.
And we want to hear from you. Did you study music as a kid? As a parent, do you want your kids to? And what do you think the benefits are? What do you get out of it in your non-musical life? You can call us, 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or tweet us. We're Central Time WPR. I'm Rob Ferret.
I'm Veronica Rickert. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network.
This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. Coming up, we'll catch up on the latest Wisconsin news with news director Michael Leland.
Now we continue our conversation about the benefits of learning music with Joanne Lippman. She's a journalist, editor, co-author of the book Strings Attached.
And we'd love to hear your story. How did learning music affect your life? Do you think it benefited you down the road, maybe helped you achieve some things? What do you think? You can call us at 1-800-642-1234. That's 1-800-642-1234. Or you can post on the Central Time Facebook page.
We'll go to Brian in Oconomowoc now. Brian, hi, you're on the air.
Hey, I love the show, love everything that's been said so far. I think it's great. For me, music has, it was the reason I ended up going on to college. I just fell in love with performing and playing and learning it. And now I'm currently actually teaching music, just finishing up school. And I think one of the most valuable things I've learned is that music can help teach something that is hard to get in many other classes, which is feeling emotion and understanding emotions and ways of expressing it and dealing with it. Not to mention, you know, it's kinesthetic, it's aural, it's so many different things. But great show, and I just wanted to add that bit being able to feel and express those emotions.
All right, Brian, thanks a lot. Joanne, what do you think about that? Music helps us deal with our emotions, work with our emotions.
I completely agree. That's something that in Strings Attached, one of the pieces that came out of it is that, and in fact, the teacher we write about, is we call Mr. K, his name was Jerzy Kopczynski. He was a Ukrainian immigrant who had this quite tragic life, and music, he was able to channel that through music into this incredible legacy of beauty and joy and success for his students. And I found the same thing when we talked to these really high achievers. A lot of them mentioned music as an emotional outlet. I mean, people as disparate as Alan Greenspan, former chairman of the Federal Reserve, and Woody Allen of Woody Allen fame, both talked about that as the importance of music as an emotional outlet.
And it's interesting that a lot of the people you learned about, they continued music, even though they weren't really getting paid for it. They made their bread and butter elsewhere, but there was something about the joy of making music that stayed with them.
Yeah, there, without question, there's something in music that is this kind of, it's joyous. It allows them to channel both their thoughts, their emotions, and their creativity in different ways. And a number of people I talked about how the process of making music opened up these pathways to creativity or to different ways of thinking. And it was very interesting. Paul Allen, who, you know, the co-founder of Microsoft, talked about how the process of creating music was similar to the process of creating kind of breakthrough coding on computers, in that both, he said, there's something that is pushing you to look beyond what currently exists and to express yourself in a new way.
All right, we'll go back to the phones now. We have Emily in South Milwaukee. Emily, hi, you're on the air.
Hi. I am a music teacher from Milwaukee Public Schools currently, so music has obviously had a very large impact in my life. What I'd like to add to this conversation is that music really is a collaborative effort. And something that I really learned was how to work with people And I love how music really just brings together people of different backgrounds, different cultures. It really is something that's very universal. So that's just something I wanted to add.
All right. Thanks, Emily. Joanne, what do you think?
I'm so glad that Emily brought that point up. I think that is one of the key points of music and one of the reasons why, both in Strings Attached and with these pieces that I've written around it, that people have cited as music for helping them to be successful in other careers is because of that ensemble playing, listening to others. There's a guy I talked to by the name of Steve Hayden, who was a legendary ad guy who created the Apple 1984 commercial that's kind of one of the most famous commercials ever. And he said music, he was a cellist, and he said he was thinking of Stravinsky, he said, when he wrote that commercial, which is so cool. But he said that what music did for him is it made him successful in advertising because he was able to listen and able to work well with others, and that people who have that training learn to work well in any environment.
All right. Well, thanks so much for that call, Emily. And let's move to Jan in Madison. Hi, Jan.
Hi. Thanks for having me on. One of the things that's so important about music is when you get involved with music, you understand that there are so many patterns and different ways to look at music.
I think we're losing your connection there, Jan, but I think we got the thrust of her comment there, Joanne, talking about being able to pick up patterns and notice things. Is music good for that?
Definitely. That's part of that mathematical connection, but it also extends beyond math into language recognition. Several people I spoke to talked about, it's called synesthesia almost, where you understand patterns and you see them. Almost, you might hear a pattern, but you can visualize it, and music kind of helps you to make these connections and see patterns that you wouldn't otherwise.
All right, thanks a lot for the call, Jan. We have Tom with us in La Crosse now. Hi, Tom.
Hi. I assume all aspiring musicians are composers, actually, in the raw, and they would like to do something on their own. And this would be a good example of how these individuals you're discussing play out their desires and needs. And mathematics would make a perfect balance to their musical concepts. What's your thoughts?
So composition in addition to performance, Joanne.
Yeah, I think that goes definitely to the creativity aspect of music. Not all musicians are composers, of course, but there is something that does free up kind of creative thinking and different ways of thinking. And on that point of the mathematics, I learned something in researching Strings Attached, which I had no idea, but the single most successful applicants to medical school are music majors. They have a better success rate than even like biology majors.
Wow, that's very interesting. Well, with that in mind, we are in an era right now when we're seeing diminishing arts education across the board, diminishing music education. So, you know, given what you've said and what you've seen, is that a mistake?
Well, I would certainly say so. In Strings Attached, one of the big messages that we hope that people will leave the book with is understanding that music education is not, it doesn't end with music. That is just the starting point. And that what we found in the book and what we found with, you know, we wrote about this really inspirational, very, very tough, very demanding music teacher in New Jersey whose students went on to outsize success in so many other fields. And I interviewed all of these students, and to say to them, you know, what was it about this one guy? And they all talked about the qualities that they used to succeed in their careers. They talked about things like resilience and focus and discipline and all these qualities that they learned in the orchestra room that translated not just into academic success, but into the tools they needed to succeed in life and in their career.
All right, we've got another caller, Barry in La Crosse now. Barry, hi.
Oh, I just wanted to share a couple of stories of early music experiences I had. I did piano as about an 8 to 10 years old. I did piano, and I had a piano recital where I broke down, like I made a big mistake in the middle of one of my pieces, and I just broke down crying. right in the recital, I couldn't figure out how to finish the piece, and had a traumatic experience, but carried on with music, and also did some Irish dance as a young child and had to get up in front of my school with a kilt and do Irish dancing in front of my whole elementary school. So now as an adult, I have this, I don't have the slightest bit of stage fright, or, you know, I'm really comfortable getting up in front of crowds now, because what could be harder than as an eight-year-old getting up in a kilt in front of your school and doing Irish dancing?
Well, Barry, I've never done that, Barry, but your experience rings true for me. I don't think I could do this job without my musical background. I, you know, stage fright and panic early doing music. I've worked through that. Making a mistake and picking up and running afterward, all from music that has helped me here. So, yeah, overcoming the maybe a fear of being up in front of other people and looking foolish, Joanne.
So true. I love that story. And I think almost every musician has a story like that. And it does help you in terms of, I certainly found it for myself. The Strings Attached, the story is of this, my childhood music teacher who taught me how to play the viola. And I didn't have to wear a kilt, but I had a very, very similar performance experience. And ever since then, I have had no fear of public speaking, because it's so much easier to talk than it is to play the viola. So I so relate to that. And one of the students, actually, of the Mr. K students that I talked with in Strings Attached, who went on to great success, she made the wisest comment, which I think is so true of the great music teachers out there, which is, she said, in our case, Mr. K, who's the subject of the book, she said, Mr. K taught us how to fail and how to pick ourselves back up again. And that's so key to anything you do in life, is you know, knowing if you mess up, knowing that you can pick yourself back up again and how to fix it.
Well, you were talking earlier about how music taught focus and discipline and qualities of perseverance. You think that could apply to, you know, other arts, maybe the fine arts, if we just practice it with those qualities in mind? Is that maybe what's special about music?
Well, I do think that there's something to be said for mentors generally, and particularly kind of very often the mentors you don't appreciate. In our case, in Strings Attached, the man we write about was really exacting and demanding, and, you know, didn't praise us if we didn't deserve it. His highest praise was not bad. He had us audition all the time and didn't sugarcoat it. You know, if we didn't do well, we didn't do well. It was just kind of focus on improving the next time. And I think in music it really lends itself to that, but I do think that you can see it in other arts and also in other fields. I mean, I think that's something in common with great coaches. One of the interesting things since Strings Attached came out is the reader response has been fascinating, because people will talk about, you know, it's a bit of a tearjerker. There's a kind of a sad story, but inspiring. But we hear from these readers who say, I finished the last page weeping, and then I reached for the phone, picked it up, and called my fourth grade soccer coach, you know, or my English professor. And I think that those qualities can exist in other areas as well.
All right. Well, Joanne, it's been so interesting. Thank you for joining us.
Oh, thank you for having me. Great conversation.
That was Joanne Lippman. She's a journalist, editor, and co-author of Strings Attached, One Tough Teacher, and The Gift of Great Expectations. We have her article on music education linked on the Central Time Facebook page. This is Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, a look at legendary jazz bandleader, composer, and performer Duke Ellington. We'll talk to the author of a new biography.
Now it's time for our weekly Wisconsin News Roundup with WPR's news director, Michael Leland.
Michael, thanks for joining us.
Glad to be here.
So, a lot going on this week. There's always a lot going on.
Always, always.
Been hearing national headlines about a big change in food stamps effective, what, today, right?
Yeah, today it's the what's called the Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program. We all know it as food stamps. It was expanded back in 2009 under the federal stimulus bill, and that boost expired last night. What had happened was the government had added about $45 billion to the program to help out with the higher demand for food assistance during the height of the Great Recession. And again, that expired last night.
So that's gone. And what does that mean here in Wisconsin? What's the impact?
Well, here in Wisconsin, the program is called Food Share, and the cuts are going to hit about 860,000 people. If you're a family of three on Food Share, your benefit is cut by about $29 a month. Now, that might not sound a lot like a lot to many of us, but people who work with those who are on Food Share say it's already tough enough to buy enough food to feed a family with this extra benefit. So they say this cut is going to hurt. In fact, Shemaine Mills reported earlier this week for us that the hardest hit areas of the state would be Milwaukee County and rural northern parts of Wisconsin, where in some areas more than half the children receive Food Share.
And does this have a domino effect beyond the people it's affecting directly, seeing that lower amount of Food Share?
Yeah, cuts are being felt in a couple of other areas. First, they're saying it's going to put greater demand on food pantries, which have already been saying that for quite a while that they're struggling to meet the demand for food. So that demand is expected to be even greater. And it even affects grocery stores to some extent, because people who receive those food share dollars are, in fact, spending them at grocery stores. So that means less money going into some grocery store cash registers around the state.
Yeah, we've heard from food pantry guests on this show that the recession created a higher demand for their services, but also lower input. People couldn't afford to donate as much as they used to, so they kind of get hit on both ends.
Exactly.
And now there's this farm bill thing out there. I know Congress is still looking at that. What's the road ahead for food stamps?
Yeah, this is where the food stamp program could be cut even more than it was cut at midnight last night. As many of us know, the food stamp program is part of the farm bill, and many of us remember that the last farm bill expired at the end of September when the last fiscal year ended, and a new bill hasn't been passed yet. There is an extension underway, but we don't have a new farm bill. And one of the things that's sort of in dispute and preventing that new farm bill from going through is how much to fund food stamps. The Senate is proposing cutting the program by about $4 billion over the next 10 years. The House wants even deeper cuts. It's proposing cuts of about $40 billion over the next 10 years. So a lot of ground to cover before we get a new farm bill and know what's going to be the future of the food stamp program in this country.
Well, Congress is always quick to reconcile these controversial issues. So,
absolutely.
What, end of next week is
we
a timeline
there? We should
knock
this out next week, no problem.
Right. Yeah. So, yeah, this will be one we're watching probably for weeks to come.
Yes.
Seriously, yeah. So here's one that maybe came and went this week. I don't know. Something new, and I'll admit, I was a little confused when I was seeing what was going on. New legislation on voter ID in Wisconsin.
Right. As you remember, back in 2011, the legislature passed a photo ID requirement for voters, and then it was blocked pretty quickly in the court. The law is also the subject of a couple of lawsuits that are seeking to overturn it. One of those suits in federal court is expected to be heard beginning on Monday. That suit challenges the law on the basis that it discriminates against Black and Hispanic voters because they're less likely to have one of the state IDs that's needed to vote. That's a driver's license or a state ID for non-drivers. The other lawsuit against it is a state suit that was filed on behalf of a woman who was born in rural Tennessee, never got a birth certificate, and has gone through a lot of trouble to try to get the required documents to get a Wisconsin ID. So all of this, I'm telling you, to tell you that yesterday there were a couple of Republican lawmakers circulating a new bill that and hope to hold a hearing on it next week that they had hoped would allow voter ID to move ahead in Wisconsin.
And what kind of changes were they looking at making?
Well, one of the things they were going to do was allow people who can't afford the fees needed to get the documents to get an ID and all this sort of thing, or can't obtain those necessary documents, this new proposal would allow them to take an oath saying that this is the case and they'd be allowed to vote. And it would also have allowed more types of ID to be used for voting, like veterans' ID cards from the Veterans Health Administration.
As you understand it, is part of the notion here to make this a little more lawsuit-proof?
Well, yes and no. You know, the hope was that this could get through and this could be a law that would stick. On the other hand, Republican Senate Majority Leader Scott Fitzgerald said he's not going to take up this bill right now. He says it makes more sense to see what happens to the lawsuits that are already pending against the current law. And the fear was that if this new law was approved by the legislature and signed by the governor, it would just trigger more lawsuits, and any effort to get a voter ID law in this state would be, you know, pushed even further down the road.
So where it looks like we're holding now on voter ID is there are these existing cases in court, mm-hmm. and we're going to sit on our hands in the legislature and not re-legislate until we know the outcome there.
That appears to be the case as of today.
Okay, yeah. A big story here in Wisconsin and in states all over the country,
yeah.
really, voter
yeah,
ID.
Really is going out around the country.
Well, here's a more maybe Wisconsin-unique story. The casino decision, Governor Walker has, I think, been releasing daily updates on what he's considering. Well, first, bring us up to date. Give us the basis of the story here.
Well, the basis of the story is that we're still waiting for a casino decision. A little bit of background. The Menominee Tribe wants to build an $800 million casino and entertainment complex in Kenosha with Hard Rock International. There are two tribes that have been against it, the Potawatomi and the Ho-Chunk. They have casinos in Milwaukee and the Dells, and they say that this new casino would siphon business away from them. Now, the governor had said that he was going to decide by last Friday whether to approve this project. He is required to be, he is the person who's got to say yes or no to this proposal.
He is the decider.
He is the decider. Will decide whether it goes ahead or not. Last week, he said he would need more information. And, so we're still waiting to hear what he decides based on that information.
He had set out, though, a while back, conditions that would be required before he would say yes to this.
A couple of things he said he wanted to see was unanimous agreement among all 11 Wisconsin tribes and that this new casino not result in any new net gambling in the state, although he hasn't really come out and say exactly what that means.
And there was a press conference yesterday. Who was talking about this? What were they saying?
Largely elected leaders from southeast Wisconsin. They were calling on the governor to approve this proposal, let this casino be built. One of their arguments has been that there's an effort in Illinois to build a casino just south of the border in Waukegan, and that if that were to happen, it would siphon gambling dollars out of Wisconsin. They say that a Menominee casino in Kenosha would prevent that from happening.
So, as I mentioned, a trickle of information. Here's what's on my mind from the governor this week. People reading the tea leaves on this, are they saying, if they're gambling people, what are the odds they're putting on it, or where are they seeing the governor lean on this?
They're saying it doesn't look good for the Menominee. They're saying it seems like the governor's trying to lay the groundwork for rejecting this proposal. Just yesterday, he pointed out again that the proposal doesn't have the support of all of Wisconsin's Native American tribes, even though the Menominee have said that it does.
That's a confusing point to me, and some other tribes have said no. Mm-hmm. In fact, we don't. We're not convinced yet.
Yes, that is the case.
So, timeline, when can we see a decision on this?
Who knows, really? The Department of Administration Secretary Mike Hipsch has said that he thinks a decision will come sometime next week. He's not saying what he thinks it's likely to be, but really, in the end, it's up to the governor to let us know when he's made up his mind and what his answer is.
And I'm guessing you over in the newsroom are ready to scramble when the governor steps up to a microphone.
We're on hold, waiting.
All right. Well, Michael, thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks a lot, Rob.
That was Michael Leland, our news director here at Wisconsin Public Radio. We check in on Wisconsin news each Friday at this time.